returning to the ongoing story of the Torah, we're moving towards the introduction of Noah. So let's continue to tell the tale, because with Noah we open up a new chapter in terms of the ongoing existence of the covenant. So God tells us when Enosh, which means mortal humankind, had lived for 90 years, he followed Canaan. Canaan means sorrowful possession. Canaan had lived 70 years, and he fathered Mahalah. Mahalah is, Ma means to question, and the law is either light or self-aggrandizement. Halal can be the radiating God's light, or it can be the first name of Hasatan, the false light. Mahalal existed 65 years, and he followed Yered, which means to descend. So from this perspective, in this parade of names, we've gone downhill. Enosh, mortal mankind, Canaan, in sorrowful possession, and Mahal to question the light, ultimately leading to Yared to descend. Now, along the way, the time from conception to conception has declined from 130 years to 105 to 90 to 70, 60 to 65. So it's likely that the 100 place was erroneously added to the Masoretic text in the next generation. And while I'm going to skip through a lot of the numbering sequence that is available for those who would like to read it in at yadayah.com, because it's difficult to follow verbally over the air, I'm still going to go through the chronology that we will see that soon leads us to Noah, because that's important. So when Yered had lived, I think, 62 years as opposed to 162, he fathered Hanok. Hanok means to educate, to dedicate, to inaugurate, to consecrate. It's usually transliterated Enoch, but it's actually Hanok in Hebrew. Hanok had lived, he had existed 65 years when he fathered Methuselah, which means male branch. Hanok, better known as Enoch, walked with God after he fathered Methuselah 300 years, and he had other sons and daughters. All the days Enoch lived were 365. Hanok, or Enoch, walked with God, and then he was not. For indeed, God had grasped hold and had taken him. Now, what's interesting here is that this was the first of what will be seven overall harvests. And not so coincidentally, Enoch was the seventh name in this list. Now, a lot of those who are into bodily resurrection theories will say that Enoch vanished, but the Hebrew word simply says he was not, Ain, which is just a Hebrew form of negation, because God had taken him. There is no value of having a body in a spiritual realm, and the only advantage of going from this world to the spiritual realm is losing the constraints of a physical body and becoming spiritual, energy-based. So beyond God wanting to be with Enoch, there are other reasons for this to have occurred. First, Yahweh wanted to impress upon us the importance of walking with him. There is no better way to make this point than by telling us that the first man who did so was grasped hold, selected, accepted, received, and acquired by God. La'ak, selected, accepted, conveys all of this. That is why Hanok's name means to educate or to be educated, to instruct or to be instructed, to dedicate, which speaks of the benefit of something being bestowed, and to inaugurate, being the first of seven harvests, even to consecrate, which means to be set apart. It is as if God is saying, by way of this man's name, I'm going to educate my people by way of this man's example, him walking with me, setting him aside from all others. He is the inaugural example of my seven harvests, demonstrating what it means to be set apart. To stress the importance of this point, after asking Abraham to leave Babylon, to leave his country, to walk away from his country, Yahweh asked the patriarch of the covenant to walk with him, to the promised land. Man walking with God is the essence of God's plan, the very reason for our existence, the purpose of the covenant. He is seeking an engaged and active relationship where we stand upright in his presence. That's the whole concept of the covenant. God gets down on his knees to lift us up. The last thing he wants is us on our knees lifting him up. It would be counterproductive. Second, everything Yahweh does follows his 6+1 plan. There are 7 harvests of souls. The first was Enoch, symbolizing the harvest of those whose company God enjoys. The second was Lot from Sodom, recognizing the removal of God's family prior to the town's destruction, as it is presented in Bereshith, Genesis 18 and 19. Again, also in 2 Shimon, or the second letter that Peter wrote. The third is Eliyah. Yah is God, is what Eliyah means, symbolizing Yisrael's return from Baal and Babylon, their restoration and harvest, and depicted in Malach Kings 2. The fourth is Yosha's fulfillment of the Mikra of Bakudim, which means firstborn children, as it is depicted in Mataniah, Matthew 27:52. It is also presented and explained in great detail in Kara, which has been renamed Leviticus 23. The fifth harvest is the pre-tribulation harvest. It's called a paralambano in Greek, although Yahusha didn't speak Greek. The term paralambano is still instructive. It means with hand-holding, with a loving embrace, the children of the covenant will be harvested. This fulfillment of this particular harvest occurs on the Mikra of Teruah, and sometime over the next now we have just 13 years for that harvest to take place. It will be, however, so small that it will not even be noticed. Less than 1 in 1,000,000 people know and accept the terms of the covenant, and only those who have will be harvested. The sixth harvest of tribulation martyrs, depicting those who have come to trust Yahweh during the trial and have been killed based upon their relationship with him, is the sixth of these 7 harvests. This event concludes with the transition between the tribulation and the millennial Shabbat in Revelation 24:4 and 7 is the harvest of millennial mortals, something which will be required as the new Jerusalem begins in Yahusha's revelation in the 21st chapter. So you have 7 harvests of saved souls. The first of those is with Enoch, or Hanok in Hebrew. Now, the third reason that Yahweh removed Hanok from the polluted planet was because he had another job for him to do. You see, Enoch will join Eliyah. Eliyah is Elijah. It means Yah is God, as one of the 2 revelation witnesses during the tribulation. Now, as we continue to discuss this narrative of our transition from Adam and Chawa being expelled from the garden to the rise of Noah, who is our trustworthy guide back to the garden, captaining the Ark of the Covenant, we find that a man named after the primary symbol for the source of life, Methuselah, lived longer than anyone in history, 969 years. And while he could well have fathered Lamech at 187 based upon the previous pattern, probably and probability and consistency dictate that we should strongly consider 87 years as the duration of time. So it's Methuselah, male branch, symbolic of the Messiah, had lived, I think it's 87 years, although the Masoretic text reads 187 years when he fathered Lamech. Lamech means he taught and informed him. When Lamech had existed 82 years, he fathered a son and called his name Noah. Noah in Hebrew, pronounced exactly the same way as it's transliterated into English, means to guide and to lead to safety. It is to lead with a peaceful, reconciling attitude. It means to be dependable, to be reliable, and to be trustworthy. It is based upon the Hebrew word nuach, meaning guide to the resting place, which is sponsored, promoted, and provided by the Ruach Spirit. So when Lamech had existed 82 years, he fathered a son called and called his name Noah, saying, "This is how he will change, console, and comfort us, Naham, cause us to reconsider so that we relent, finding relief from our practices, customs, and deeds, Masayah, work, labor, pursuits, and habits, from the pain and suffering of our hands, and from the earth, which relationally Yahweh has cursed." So here we have the introduction of Noah, which whose name speaks of him being a spiritual guide, someone who is dependable, trustworthy, and reliable, taking us from a troubled place to a place where we can rest. And then we are told that this is how God is going to change us, change our direction, change our attitude, change our perspective away from the practices, customs, and deeds, the ma'aseh. The ma'aseh is the Hebrew word for work that is the basis of ma'aseh, which means the work of Yahweh. And so God wants to change our thinking, our perspective, and our direction away from those practices, customs, and deeds, those pursuits, that work, which results in pain and suffering. Now, so much of what we do is particularly in human institutions, political institutions, military institutions, economic and religious institutions, those practices, those customs cause pain and suffering. And that was the condition on the earth, and God wanted to take us away from that, which is the purpose of the Ark of the Covenant. It is the purpose of the covenant. It is the why the first requirement to participate in the covenant is to walk away from politics and religion. So God is not only saying that he wants us to change our direction regarding these things, but he's also said that the pain and suffering that we are enduring is of our own making. It's of our own hands. It comes from us. But it also comes from the fact that to honor the promise that he made to Adam, the earth has been cursed. It no longer is as productive as it was designed to be. As we dig a little deeper into the revelation, we learn that Noah's name tells us that he was a metaphor for Yahweh, especially for Yahweh's manifestation as Yahusha. He is being established as a guide who leads mankind to safety. His attitude and approach to life makes him a dependable, reliable, and trustworthy leader. And that's what the name means. His moniker defines his purpose, which is to change mankind's attitude, mankind's thinking, our direction, to get us to realize that our social customs and religious practices, our pursuits, ambitions, and habits are counterproductive. They need to be revised. God's testimony and man's are wholly different. The paths that religions provide all lead in the opposite direction that God's guidance tells us to follow. So just because everyone else is doing it does not make it right. This was the time for man to relent. It still is. And for those who elect to trust and rely upon this guide and his God, this is an opportunity to exit the world of human pain and suffering. This is what return to the Garden of Eden is all about. In Noah, we find the way home, which is to rely on the covenant, to rely on Yahweh, to pay attention to his instructions, to embrace them, and to sail away from human institutions, whether they be popular religious myths or popular political myths, whatever it may be. God says that if you choose to rely on men, then you are automatically excluded from his company. Also be aware that this passage confirms that Yahweh did what he told Adam would do. Remember, he said to Adam, because you have listened to the voice of your wife and have eaten from the tree which I directed you, saying, do not eat from it, cursed is the ground, because you shall labor to eat from it all the days of your life. Thorns and thistles shall sprout up as you consume the vegetation from the open environs outside of the garden. By the sweat of your brow you shall feed yourself bread until you return to the ground from which you were taken. And surely to the earth you shall return. What God is, of course, telling us is that in the covenant, as part of his family in the garden, he is responsible for nurturing us, for caring for us. In eternity, he will provide everything that we need, just as he did in the garden, just as he will when we celebrate our return to the garden here in 20 years. So when we choose instead to rely on ourselves, to disregard God's guidance, then we are responsible for our own well-being. And we have done a pretty lousy job at that, and it's why we suffer. These things, Noah, when we are dealing with Noah, what we recognize is that the flood serves as a millennial marker in the 7,000-year history of humankind that whose clock began to tick the moment we were expelled from the garden. That does not say that the earth and the universe are 6,000 years old. Quite the contrary. The testimony Yahweh presents about creation reveals that his creative endeavors are still in the sixth day, and the 6 days from the perspective of the Creator as a witness to creation is approximately 14 to 15 billion years from our perspective. Now, we know this because of the microwave radiation, that's the background radiation, that is the result of the Big Bang, a term that Yahweh himself coined in the Torah. And what we notice when we study this microwave background radiation is that the wavelength is stretched 10 to the 12th power. When you do the math and you compare the rate that time flowed based upon a 10 to the 12th stretching of these wavelengths, which you recognize once you do the math, is that 6 24-hour days on Earth are exactly equivalent to the time that would have been experienced by someone at creation. They are identical. What we would view as 15 billion years looking back using our timepiece is exactly 6 days from the perspective of someone at creation. The 6,000-year timeline plus one for the millennial celebration of Sukkah and the Sabbath, that timeline begins with the expulsion of Adam and Chavo from the garden. 1,000 years after they were expelled is the flood. And with that recognized, which is important to realize that these millennial markers are not nearly as essential. They are simply confirmation dates. They are not fulfillment dates. Yahweh's overall plan occurs on integrals of 40 yobels, not 20. A yobel is a 50-year period. And so 40, which is the number of the completion of a time of testing, times 50 years is 2,000 years. And this is simply a 1,000-year marker and thus a confirmation date. Let's return a moment to Yahweh's timeline. 40 is always presented throughout Yahweh's testimony as a time of testing, the completion of a time of testing. For example, it rained 40 days and 40 nights. Yahusha was tested 40 days and 40 nights. You have the children of Yisrael wandering in the wilderness for 40 years. 40 is always the time of a period of testing. God's very much into the math, and 40 is the time that he has established. The Yobel take place every 50 years. They are translated Jubilee, even though there's no J in Hebrew. Yovel means Yah's Lamb is God, is what the term actually means. And it is on the Yovels that Yahweh does his most important work. So if you want to understand God's timeline, you take 40, which is the period of testing, and you multiply it by the Yovel, which is 50, and you find that there are three 2,000-year increments, three 40 Yovel increments that are essential as part of God's plan. And if you want to look at what happened 2,000 years after Adam and Chawa had been booted from the garden in 1968 BCE, you will find Abraham and Yahweh establishing a covenant, which is means back into God's family. 2,000 years after that, exactly the same place on Mount Moriah is when Yahusha fulfilled the first four of the Moed Mikre, these invitations to meet with God, and therefore enabled each of the covenant's benefits by fulfilling in the year 4000 Yah, which was 33 CE in our pagan calendars, Pesach, Matzah, Bukurim, and Shavua, the first four of the Mikra. Then as we move forward to 2,000 years or 40 Yovel, from 33 CE, we come to 2033 CE, just 20 years from now, which will mark year 6,000 Yah, which is when he will return. He will return on Yom Kippurim, the day of reconciliation, and 5 days later on Sukkah, which means to camp out, he will return the entire earth back to the conditions experienced in the Garden of Eden, except no one will enjoy that who hasn't embraced the terms and conditions of the covenant. So if you want to survive between now and that time, it's important that you open the pages of the Torah and consider the five conditions for participating in the covenant and embrace them. If you do, you will receive its benefits. So we're looking from 1968 BCE to 33 CE. For the historic markers of the fulfillment of the first two 40 Yovel periods, with the third commencing in 2033, which is year 6000 Yah. So that's the timing, all of which is conveyed, being conveyed by these timelines that we have witnessed up to the birth of Noah. Now, as we consider all of this, we find that Yahweh has conveyed information that has provided us with the insights necessary, the clues necessary for us to understand everything that's important to him. Now, that is not to say that the 1,000-year markers were not germane to confirmations of God's plan. For example, we're about to begin the story of the flood. It occurred in year 1000 Yah, or in this particular case, this would be 2968 BCE. We have lots of evidence for it, and over these next few programs, we're going to delve into the proof that there was a regional flood that existed precisely where God said it would, did exactly what he said it was going to do, and occurred exactly when he said it occurred. Proof of that is fascinating, but it comes by way of the Burkle Crater off of the mouth of the Tigris and Euphrates rivers. Now, these 1,000 markers, the first of them is the flood in 1,000 Yah, but then if you move to year 3000 Yah, which would be 968 BCE, what you find is that's the time that Solomon, based upon what his father had done, Dod, whom we call David, laid the cornerstone of the first temple, which is the home of Yahweh on earth. The home represents being invited into his company, into the covenant family. Then the next millennial marker that would be set between year 33 CE and 2033 would be 133 CE, and it was during that time that there was a flood of Byzantine pilgrims to Jerusalem, and yet the waters under the temple were poisoned. Most of them died. The poisoning of the waters beneath the temple is presented in the Torah and Bamidbar in the wilderness, Numbers 5. It's a divorce decree. It says that if the waters beneath the temple become septic, if they become poisonous, then you can know that I am saying that I am divorcing myself of you because you have been unfaithful. And so those are the millennial markers along the way. Now, as we open the sixth chapter of In the Beginning, which has been renamed Genesis, it means it's Bereshith in Hebrew. Translators of English Bibles typically ignore both Haya and Ki, Haya being either when or speaking of existence, and ki meaning indeed, and then they pass over halal as if it were not there. And they say, when man began to multiply, is how they convey it. And yet, you can't get that out of the Hebrew. Now, while man may well have begun to multiply in terms of numbers, the text actually reads, indeed, which is from Ki, it came to be, or pass, which is from Haya, that mankind, Adam, this would now not be just Homo sapiens in general, but by using Adam, not Enosh, not Ish, the other words that speak of humankind, but Adam would be, is mankind as descendants from Adam and Chawa, and therefore these would be humans with a nesama, with a conscience. So indeed it came to be that mankind, Adam, defiled and profaned, halal. Halal does not mean to multiply. It means to defile, to profane, to treat with contempt, to desecrate, to dishonor, to pollute, to wound, to invalidate. And it is for this reason that halal is, according to Yahweh, the first name, in fact, the name of Hasatan, the adversary. You'll find that his name is Halal ben Shakar. Halal is his name. Ben means son of. Shakar is the rising sun. So, indeed, it came to pass that mankind defiled and profaned the face, the pana, of the earth. And increasingly, daughters were born to them. So, the sons of Adam would be those who were descendants of Adam and Chawa, they became profane. They became polluted and invalid. They were no longer capable of having a relationship with Yahweh because they had become too corrupt. And they managed to destroy this entire region, which is Adama. And increasingly, these sons of Adam married the daughters that were born to Homo sapiens. So Ra'ab, increasingly the daughters were born to them. Anyone born of someone who was a descendant of Adam and Chawa would have a nesama. Now, we covered Halal because it reveals who was responsible for this fallen state. It is Halal is Satan's name. Chawa was the first, but not the only or the last person the adversary beguiled. Now, to better appreciate Hasatan's influence on man and the earth, let's review the meaning of Halal's English synonyms without any religiosity. That way we'll be able to better understand who Satan is and what he was trying to accomplish and how he worked through the descendants of Adam to corrupt their relationship with Yahweh. First, to defile is to trample down and to make unclean and impure. It is to corrupt that which is good, sullying, dishonoring, and contaminating it. This is what Satan did to Adam and Chawa, and what he continues to do to beguile mankind today, suggesting that the adversary has a very limited arsenal of tricks. His primary trick is to corrupt, to counterfeit what God has said. To profane is to abuse something which is set apart, to treat something good with contempt. It is to debase, to make unworthy and vulgar. Mankind was created good, valuable, worthy, but we have been profaned by our own doing, debased and made unworthy. To desecrate is to violate the sanctity or worth of something once it is good. It means to treat disrespectfully or irreverently. Now, there is nothing more sacred, nothing more important or valuable to God than a human soul. So in this regard, halal sought to debase human souls, making what was once beautiful vulgar, subverting individual relationships between man and God. To treat with contempt is to despise. It stems from a lack of respect. Contempt is willfully doing that which shows no regard for that which is worthy. Knowing Yah, trusting Yah, relying upon and loving Yahweh are predicated on the very notion of respecting Him. It is why Satan despised these things. It is why he had the likes of Paul condemn Yahweh's testimony to discard the Torah. Because if you disregard God's guidance, this willful act will lead to the separation of a soul from God and the devaluing of that soul so that it is no longer worthy. At this point, Yah makes a distinction between the two types of humans. And there were two types of humans on the planet. Ones with a Nesama that were descendants of Adam and Chawa, and those without a Nesama who were simply Homo sapiens but without a conscience. Some folks were simply animals, you know, perhaps some still are. This says, the sons of the Mighty One, this would be sons of the Almighty, saw that the daughters of men were really beautiful. So now they took any of them that they chose or desired as their women or as their wives. And when we return to the last segment of Shattering Myths today, we will analyze specifically what God is telling us in this statement and in the one which follows. We'll be back in a moment. Well, we'll come back to the final segment of Yadaya's presentation of Shattering Myths for today and for this week. We have read here that the sons of the Almighty saw that the daughters of men were really beautiful, so they took all of them that they chose as their wives, as their women. Now, from this, so many crazy interpretations have been that these sons of the Almighty were somehow spiritual beings, and that these mighty ones were like the angels, like the Malach, the messengers, and that they chose women as wives. But God has made it painfully clear to us that as a spiritual being, they have no sexual capacity. There is no marrying. There is no wives. There's no procreation amongst spiritual beings. So this is just really the sons of God. To be a son of God, Adam was a child of God. He begot Adam in his image. And so those who were begotten from Adam, who are descendants of Adam and Chawa, would be considered sons of the Almighty. And they had something that was unique that made them infinitely more capable than the other Homo sapiens, daughters of men that were existing on the planet, and that they had a Nesama. They had a conscience, the ability to reason. So they took them as their wives. Now, in that Yahweh created Adam in his image, blowing his Nesama conscience into him, it is reasonable to consider Adam's offspring as sons of God. The daughters of men would represent other Homo sapiens who were roaming around east of Eden. The reason that the Nesama-equipped humans were able to have any woman they wanted was because of the overwhelming advantage judgment, discernment, and reason gave them over lesser-equipped people. Profaning his creation, treating it with contempt, multiple wives, and living outside of his family model was, of course, not the course that Yah had plotted. As such, Yahweh said, "My spirit, my ruach, will not remain in or contend and plead with mankind for an unlimited duration of time. Also, as a result of him being flesh, his days shall be 120 years. All right, a couple of thoughts here that God has conveyed for our understanding. God has said, you know, I'm not going to put up with you forever. You know, if you're going to be corrupt, there's only a limited amount of time that I'm going to deal with you. And it also is to say that God can and has put us on notice that if we are polluted, that he's not going to contend with us. He's saying that his spirit will not remain and contend with or plead with mankind for olam and unlimited, for an unlimited duration of time. So quite clear that God does not attempt to save everyone, that God does not have a relationship with everyone, but that he is quite limiting in terms of who he chooses to encounter. The second aspect of this is that basar, being flesh, is not a good thing. Yeah, there's nothing wrong with it in the sense of it's better than nothing, but flesh compared to spirit is inferior. Now, in the present form, we have our conscience, which is a form of energy, and we can use our nesama to connect our conscience with Yahweh's spirit, and that produces a perfect result. But flesh decays. You know, it's the reason that we do not want physical bodies in eternity. It's why there are no bodies in heaven. A physical body and physical bodily resurrection would be counterproductive. So God is saying, you know, I'm just going to limit the lifespan of humanity. It's not going to exceed 120 years, and we see that even to this day, that the lifespan of mankind does not exceed 120 years. So prior to the flood, the water vapor shield, which Yahweh spoke about in Bereshit 2:6, at least in this time and place, would have precluded the sun's most damaging rays from eroding the elasticity of our cells. This would have enabled humans living then and there to renew themselves at a much faster rate for a much longer period of time. It's the reason all that dinosaurs existed on the planet as well. This combined with a less disease-ridden and degraded genome at the time would have enabled the perfectly designed humans who emerged from the garden to live for a very long period of time. But this was about to end. True to his word, from this time forward, 120 years has become the maximum extent of human life. And we'll continue to explore human life when Shattering Myths continues on Monday. May Yah bless.